Nighttime on Still Waters. This is NB506812, narrowcasting into the night from somewhere on Britain's waterways. December 7th, Thursday. Untidy smoke trails of jackdaws stream across an iron sky, scolding wind and rain flail. Maggie and I pick our way across the sheep field. December sings through the oaks. Will you join us on an incredibly wild and stormy night tonight? The heavy rain has passed through, but there's a battering westerly wind that's rigging across the Worcestershire vales. At the moment, it's measuring in excess of 20 miles an hour and gusts of over 30 miles an hour, which is fairly rare for such a central location as this. When Maggie and I came in a little while ago, the ground was scattered with broken alder twigs and knuckles of ash. However, we're safe and snug here. The stove is on and glowing ruby, and the kettle is about to boil. So this is the Narrowboat Erica, narrowcasting into the darkness of a wild December night, to you, wherever you are. It's lovely to see you. Thank you so much for dropping by. So shake off those muddy boots, hand me your coat, and make yourself comfortable. I was hoping you'd be able to come. Welcome aboard. It's been a howling kind of a week, with blustery winds and a lot of drenching rain. And the barometer's needle has been dancing around the dial recently. And the sheep on the hillside look thoroughly soaked. But they're a rugged, hardy lot, stocky, big, pugnacious. I did ask once what breed they were, and I was told that they were part Clan, but what they'd been crossed with couldn't be remembered. They certainly have the air of Welsh mountains and the rack of sea mist about them. There's an audaciousness about them that I like. Square, boxers' faces. And they have that pugilist swagger about them too. They will stare down Maggie at the drop of a hat or the stamp of a hoof, even moving up to us as if to dare us to try to pass them. And this week the temperatures have now lifted again with sweeping arcs of Atlantic storm fronts. Low pressure causes the air to rise like water going down a plug hole, but in reverse. In the northern hemisphere, this rising mass of air cycles in a clockwise direction. The lower the pressure, the more severe the cyclonic spin. It's all been a bit cyclonic recently. And particularly earlier today, when a warm wind banged and buffeted us. It still is. And when out in windy rain, Maggie has perfected a Clint Eastwood look. On rigid little legs, she lowers her body and her head into the wind and narrows her eyes into tiny slits, and she stares intently into the middle distance. It's as if she's waiting for a director to yell, "Close up and cut." First of all, can I pass on Dad's heartfelt thank yous to everyone who, through this podcast, wished him a happy birthday. He's thrilled, and also quite tickled by the fact that his fame, or in his words, his notoriety, is spread across the globe. So thank you. And I also know how touched and proud he is that so many people have enjoyed and are enjoying Mum's writings. So thank you all again. And thank you for your comments on last week's episode in particular. And hello to Karen Smith and to Tony Bell. And Tony, I might be imagining it, but I seem to remember that you too used to remove the rotor arm from, I think it must have been the minivan, when we used to go out camping. And hello also to Jason Polite. Yes, these unplanned moments of fate upon which lives and our destinies seem to pivot are fascinating, aren't they? I think that all my best decisions are the ones that I didn't actually make. And Jason also asked about whether there were any photographs of Mum's car, Joe. And yes, there are. And they're on the page for the episode on the NOSW Pod website. I apologise that the quality isn't brilliant, but you can at least get an impression of Joe. And I sometimes forget that most listeners probably do not get to see the episode pages as you happen to be listening via a podcast directory like Apple or Spotify. However, as the word limit for the programme notes is quite small, I try to include a little more information and at least one photograph per episode on the Nighttime on Stillwater's website. And there should be a link to click through to on the directory that you're using. And I've also collected together the links of all the episodes in which I read from Mum's books onto a separate page, which also includes a number of photographs. So if you've not heard them before or you want to hear them again, this would be a good place to start. And you will find it by clicking on the tab, The Start of It All, that you will find in the menu that runs across the top of the website page. However, I will also include a link to it in the program notes below. And it was lovely to hear back from Penny Compton. And Penny, I'm so glad that you enjoyed it. And I must get round to reading some more of Mum's later writings. She has such a store of memories featuring your mum and dad that I know you'll love. And also, of course, those camping trips that we took up to Teesdale. You know, I often think about those holidays up there. They're something special, weren't they? And hello to Anna McKellar, and thank you for your comments. And yeah, I totally agree with you. And Anna also remembers taking out the rotor arm as a security measure. And the episode also evokes some memories from Derek Watts on the narrowboat Silver Fox. And he wrote, "My first car was an Austin 10, which needed a decoke and took me all of 6 months to accomplish, having no experience and no user's manual to refer to. A lasting memory was dropping one of the valve stem half cotters down the exposed end of the exhaust pipe, which necessitated taking off the exhaust just to retrieve it." And he finishes with, "Happy days." Yes, I bet. And hello to Kaz, and thank you, and I'm really glad you enjoyed the episode. And also thank you to Captain Arlo, and thank you, Daddy's feeling better. And thank you again to Tony Rutherford. And Tony, I'd love to hear you talk about your old days. You strike me as the sort of person with a rich fund of stories and an even richer fund of wisdom. You must get down to recording some. And over on Spotify, hello and thank you to Harry from New York. And I'm really pleased that you enjoyed that Battered Landscapes episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to comment on it. And also special mention to Deb, and a big virtual hug to you and thinking of you. Follow the smiles, Deb. Follow the smiles. They're Callie's way of helping you through this. And finally, I'm overjoyed to welcome to our rank of stalwart lock keepers, Rebecca Russell. Thank you so much, Rebecca. And thank you also for your really kind words about this podcast. I'm so pleased that you're enjoying it so much. And thank you also for spreading the word about it. I really do appreciate it. So, with special thanks to all our lock wheelers for supporting this podcast, Rebecca Russell, Alison on the Narrowboat Mucker, Derek and Pauline Watts, Anna V, Sean James Cameron, Orange Cookie, Donna Kelly, Mary Keane, Tony Rutherford, Arabella Holtzapfel, Rory with MJ and Kayla, the Narrowboat Precious Jet, Linda Reynolds-Birkins, Richard Noble, Carol Ferguson, Tracy Thomas, Mark and Tricia Stowe, and Madeline Smith. Thank you. Well, welcome to the second part of our celebration of Dad's 95th birthday. And with the help of Mum's book, we're going back in time with him to the time when they first met. And last week, we heard about how Joe, a 1938 patchwork blue Hillman Minx, was so instrumental in bringing Mum and Dad together. Joe had developed a disconcerting rattle, and so Mum had dropped into her local garage where Dad just happened to be working as a mechanic. It was always the topic of much laughter and jokes in our family that the first thing that Dad did was to offer to lend her a book on how to drive. But that high-risk strategy, well, is it only a high-risk strategy today? It clearly worked anyway, and they soon began to go out together and eventually decide to marry. And we heard about that they decided on a honeymoon on the Norfolk Broads, and they'd even booked a 16-foot sailing boat called the Whippet, and then they went about planning the wedding. They wanted to get married in Mum's local church at Rickmansworth. However, when it came time to organise it, a problem emerged. The vicar wasn't available for that day, unless they held the service at 8 o'clock in the morning, something that Mum and Dad had no problems with, although it did raise a few comments from friends and families. Well, Joe, Mum's beloved Hillman Minx that had so fortuitously brought them together, continued to play an important role in their courtship too. And one quick point before I begin that I think's worth mentioning is that, as Mum had noted in last week's reading, although it's not unknown for a woman to own and drive a car, it was highly unusual. And she mentioned that from time to time she did receive some tart comments about it. However, what was perhaps even more unusual was for a man to be driven around by a woman, especially when he could drive and had his own car. Therefore, much kudos and respect to Dad for flying in the face of such social conventions, which must have at times at least felt a little awkward. Penny Compton, who I mentioned earlier, was once famously heard to describe Mum and Dad, who this time must have been probably in their 50s, as the two middle-aged hippies. Okay, there was no tie-dye or long hair or mystic chanting, and certainly no consumption of questionable substances, apart from the odd pint of beer or glass of wine. But the more I learn about them and their singular way of living their life together according to their own patterns and paths, the more I think she's correct. But I'm straying from the point. Let's return back to the winter of 1954-55. To pick up Mum's story, and yet again, it's a story in which Joe plays a central part. During that winter, we had a great deal of snow. I recall one evening after a particularly heavy fall that we decided it would be fun to take the car out onto the Denham bypass. As this was during the evening after work, Pa was absolutely horrified. He could think of nothing worse. It was my first experience of driving on snow-covered roads, and I thought it a wonderful idea. We drove down to the large garage at the end of the bypass, and filled up with petrol, and braved the elements once more. This practice put me in good stead, as for some reason Mick was suddenly without transport, so I offered to pick him up and take him to work. I remember having to get up very early in the morning, and having to scrape the snow away from the front of the garage doors before I could get the car out. Once out on the road, it was not at all bad until I had to negotiate the very steep hill out of Rickmansworth, Batchworth Hill. Halfway up, one really needed to change gear, but with the slippery state of the road, that could be one's undoing. And gosh, this was without synchromesh as well, wasn't it? The best thing was to get up it in a low gear without having to falter. But one morning, I came really unstuck. When on reaching the halfway point, I found a Green Line bus was in trouble. There was no way I could get past it. So that meant that I had to get back down the hill and find an alternative way to Northwood Hills. There was another route, but that road was a lot narrower, and tended to be less used. But I felt that it was worth a try, and in spite of having another nasty steep little hill, I made it, and Mick got to work without being too late. And it must have been about this time that I parked Joe outside the house. The house was on a very steep hill, so I always pointed the wheels into the curb, and that morning was no exception. But later, looking out of the window, I was appalled to see that Joe had disappeared. And looking down the road, there was the car, several houses down on the opposite side of the road, and having mounted the pavement and had gone into the front garden, having first broken down the wooden fence. What had happened was that the snow had melted slightly, and although I had put the wheels against the curb, there had in fact been a large lump of snow between, which had melted, and Joe had slid down the slippery surface. Very shakily I knocked on the front door of the owners of the front garden, offering my apologies and promising to make good the fence and retrieve the car. Life at Nestles was progressing well, and I was enjoying it there, especially now that I was engaged. It rather added spice to everything, and everyone was so pleased for me. On my late turn, I would drive back through Ruislip, and Mick would meet me at the top of Ducks Hill Road, where it joined the northward Rickmansworth Road. He would come on the motorbike, and we would sit and chat for a while before going off to our separate homes. And one night we'd been sitting chatting, and we noticed another car parked in front of us. There's no reason why you shouldn't park there, but it seemed odd. Then after a little chat, we said good night and set off home. Mick off towards Northwood Hills, me towards Ricky. And as I passed the car, I thought I heard the driver put it into gear. But again, why shouldn't he? And I thought no more. But as I was travelling towards Ricky, I had the feeling that I was being followed. The car behind me was quite distinctive in that it had orange headlamps, common on the continent but never seen on British cars. There were very few imported cars in those days. And I decided to slow right down so as to encourage the chap behind to overtake. But he didn't. He also slowed down. I then accelerated. He did too. And in this manner I drove to Rickmansworth, eventually driving down Batchworth Hill into the town, not without a sigh of relief. As I drove through Church Street, I saw a couple I knew, and as they lived not far from me, I offered them a lift, which they gladly accepted. But in doing this, I had to go out of my way slightly, leaving my normal route home. My follower had disappeared anyway, so that was a relief. After I had dropped my friends at their house, I made my way home, approaching it from the opposite direction, and on nearing our house, I was staggered to see Mick lurking in the shadows. As the last I had seen of him, he was heading towards Northwood Hills. Apparently, like me, he had also heard the car being put into gear, so after giving the impression that he had gone off toward Northwood, he had, in fact, doubled back and followed the car to see what he was up to, but had then lost him. As he was now in Ricky, Mick decided that he would pop up to our house to make sure that I had arrived safely. And of course, he was a bit apprehensive to find me getting back a bit later than I had due to the detour. So I told him that I was aware of what was happening, but that the chap had disappeared. But Mick said that as he had hidden just inside our gateway waiting for my return, so the car had driven slowly past the house. So whoever the driver was not only knew that I was working late that night, but also knew where I lived, which is all rather unnerving, to say the least. The next day I wandered around the car park at Nestles to see if I could spot the car with similar headlamps, as they were so distinctive. We felt that it could quite possibly be someone from work, as he could easily find out whether I was on my late turn at night, as it altered each week, but I couldn't find anything remotely similar. We also dropped into the police station at Ricky, and although they were concerned on our behalf, there was nothing much that they could do or suggest on such slender information. For a while I made sure that all my doors were locked on the inside, and I also carried that rather lethal weapon, the stick with a lump of lead on the end. Fortunately, I never had to resort to using that, nor did I ever see that car again. It remained an unsolved mystery. So gradually the summer months rolled by, and the day of our wedding got nearer. It had been arranged between Chick and the old boy that Helen and Moz would also move down to Beltinge and live with them. Helen suffered very badly with asthma, and Moz, who was now more or less blind, needed a lot of attention. And it was felt that, for all concerned, it would be better if Chick could be around to help them both. So it suggested that we took over the flat to start with. And with that in view, we didn't have to worry about finding somewhere to live. We would move in as it stood. But we did start collecting some bits and pieces together in the way of china and knick-knacks. We used to save threepenny bits, and when we saw something we liked, we bought it. And gradually we were getting quite a lot of things for our bottom drawer. And Pa said that he would give us Joe as a wedding present, as I was still paying off the loan, and there was still a sizable portion left. We were thrilled with that, as we were going to need all the money that we had. Then, about a month before the wedding, we were contacted by the curate. Mr. Hart was away on holiday. Apparently, when our banns were about to be put up, it was realised that I did not live in the parish of Rickmansworth, as I believe, but in the parish of Chorley Wood. This meant, by rights, I could not be married in Rickmansworth. We could get married in the parish church in Northwood, but we wanted Mr. Hart to perform the ceremony. And apart from that, we always considered St. Mary's as our church, and we had never been inside the one in Chorley Wood. It was all to do with the parish boundary. Hill Rise, in which our house was situated, was just inside the Chorley Wood parish. The only thing that the curate could think of was contacting the bishop to see if that he would grant us a special license. This happily was granted, and so our original plans went ahead. Mick and I were married at St. Mary's Church, Rickmansworth, on September the 3rd, 1955. April, Mum's sister, was my matron of honour, and Mick's close friend, Peter Knocker, was his best man. The Reverend Frederick Hart conducted the ceremony. It was a wonderful service. And after we had signed the register and had our photographs taken, we all wandered down the road in the September sunshine to the Checkers restaurant, where the reception was being held, and welcomed all our guests. In spite of the fact that the wedding had taken place at 8 o'clock in the morning, there were a great many guests, and quite a few having travelled some way to get there. My old hostel friend Jackie, who was now married, had travelled up from Kent with her small daughter Hilary, also her sister, Nicky. And Miss Chatterley, my boss from Nestles, remarked that it was the first time that she had gone to a wedding on a workman's bus ticket. Those tickets are now things of the past, were available to passengers if they travelled before a certain time in the morning. It was a reduced rate. I believe they had to arrive at their destination before 7:30 in the morning. And Mick always vowed that he was halfway to work before he remembered what day it was. As soon as we could, we left the reception and went back to the flat in Northwood Hills to change and make an early start for our journey to Norfolk. We were to pick up our home for the next 2 weeks, a small sailing boat. That in itself proved an impossibility, for before we knew it, many of the guests also appeared at the flat, on the pretext of seeing our wedding presents, but really to give us a fitting send-off. Plenty of confetti, a large just-married notice drawn by Roger, her brother, which was stuck on the back of my Hillman Minx Joe. And when we did eventually manage to get away, there was the inevitable clanging of tin cans tied to the bumper. And by the time we reached the end of the road, there was a strong smell of kipper that someone had tied to the exhaust pipe. We had to stop to remove the now pungent-smelling fish, and at the same time, Mick removed the string of tin cans and hung them on a nearby car. It was lucky that we had this hold-up, for as we were sorting all this out, Pa suddenly appeared on the scene. He had apparently been left behind in the restaurant. As he said, He was just settling the bill when, on turning round, he found the place empty. Fortunately, he found someone who could give him a lift. But we would have missed him if we hadn't have had to stop at the end of the road. We were so glad that we were still around when he eventually arrived. We were travelling to Norfolk in Joe. And we were in the forefront of fashion, had we realised, in that we were dressed identically, in today's jargon, unisex clothes. Mick's aunt, Helen, had made us both duffel coats, and we were both wearing corduroy trousers, very serviceable and comfortable for our next 2 weeks afloat. We, of course, didn't remove the notice from the back of the car, and we got many cheery waves from other road users, including a thumbs-up sign from a couple of RAF boys who had tried to hitch a lift. It was a lovely day, and the autumn sunshine made the countryside seem even more beautiful, and Joe purred along without a murmur. By midday I was getting very hungry, so we stopped at a hotel for lunch. And soon a very welcome meal was placed before us, which soon disappeared as far as I was concerned, but Mick found that he couldn't face his at all. And it was, without much difficulty, that I finished his off as well. I think that we react rather differently in times of excitement or stress. We set off once more and finally reached our destination, Wroxham, about 4 o'clock, where we were to pick up the boat. We set about finding the boatyard, Collins, but it was rather like looking for a needle in a haystack. There were so many small yards, and by now I was beginning to feel the pangs of hunger again. So when we saw a policeman, we decided to call on his help, and having seen the notice on the back of the car, he came over to us with a large grin and said that surely we didn't need his help so soon. But he soon put us in the right direction for both the boatyard and the nearest snack bar, where a large cheese sandwich soon put me back on my feet again. When we got to the boatyard, we found that the boat was having to have some minor repairs done to it, so wouldn't be ready for an hour or so. We were getting rather apprehensive, as the time was getting on, and being September, the evenings were already beginning to draw in. But eventually, all was ready for us, and we stowed away our luggage, and also the previously ordered provisions from Roy's of Wroxham, which had been delivered to the boat. Our home for the next 2 weeks was a 16-foot sailing boat with an outboard motor. There was a small cabin with two bunks, with stowage space under each, and a table. The toilet was at the far end of the cabin. The roof could be raised at night to give further headroom. The boat was called the Whippet, which was rather a misnomer, as it was quite tubby affair and rather unwieldy to handle under sail. We had some very quick instructions on the setting up of the sails, and even more important on how to use the outboard engine. It was by now getting dark, and we didn't want to spend our first night in the boatyard. So once we were ready, Mick got the outboard going, and away we puttered into the gloaming. Fortunately, we'd not gone very far down the river when we came upon Wroxham Broad. Night had closed down on us, but we could just see a post sticking out of the water. Gratefully, we tied the boat to it, and I set to prepare the first meal of our married life, bacon and eggs. It was too dark to do anything more exotic. My kitchen was a primer stove in the open cockpit, and when we got ready for bed, we discovered that Mick's pyjamas were missing. These, we found out later, had been removed by our friends who had fully intended putting them back, but in the excitement had forgotten to do so. Or so they said. In the morning, we were woken by a thumping on the roof of the cabin, and on looking out, we found a little man in a rowing boat asking for a mooring fee. The irony of it was that the post we thought was for mooring was actually informing us that there were mudflats there. Luckily, we had not gone aground, so had no difficulty in setting off again after breakfast. The weather was still lovely, and the scenery very beautiful. As we cruised down the main river, we passed the entrances to the many broads into which we went, and moored up at the Staithe. We would then leave the boat and wander down to the nearby village, which, more often than not, contained little more than a few houses and the village store. The smaller rivers we found very attractive, as they tended to be very narrow and twisting, giving them added charm. We explored everywhere. There was relatively little traffic on the broads in those days, and the picturesque dikes and inlets produced many attractions. Part of the charm was coming upon the unexpected. Down one inlet, we found an old chap who lived in a converted barge, and his hobby was making ships in bottles. He was surrounded by them. They were all shapes and sizes, and the workmanship was superb. Our one disappointment were the pubs. They were, on the whole, most unattractive and, in some cases, positively gloomy. Maybe we were spoilt by those we had found in our own locality. One that sticks out in our memory was particularly unwelcoming, was as we entered the bar, the place seemed to be in darkness, except for one corner, where there was a small black and white television set, and huddled around that were a group of locals. It was more than we dared to raise our voices above a whisper. Needless to say, we didn't stay there very long. After we'd been on the boat a couple of days, we met up with the Simmonses. There was father, who was something in the city, mother, and teenage daughter Jennifer. They had a large, luxurious cruiser, and were regular visitors to the Norfolk Broads. As soon as we met them, they seemed to want to take us under their wing. We spent quite a lot of our holiday with them, but we had to be very careful not to take advantage of their hospitality, as they were able to entertain us on their boat, whereas ours was far too small to reciprocate, and they were not keen on our treating them when we went out with them in the evenings. But they were very good company, and also very thoughtful, as was shown on the last evening of our holiday. We had moored just outside Wroxham, so as to be ready to hand over the boat the following morning. We were feeling rather low now that the holiday was nearly over, and once we had packed everything up, we felt that we could do with a drink. We hoped that perhaps Wroxham might be able to produce brighter pubs than those we had found up to date. But we were out of luck. We found ourselves in one that was drearier than ever. We were sitting there, disconsolately drinking our beer, when the door suddenly burst open, and in walked the Simmonses. They had been scouring the pubs for miles around, as they guessed that we were probably feeling sad, and knowing that the local hostelries alike, they decided that if they could find us, they would take us somewhere a bit more exciting. They too were handing over their boat in the morning, and had already got their car out of the boatyard. They swept us off with them, and we had a lovely evening, a fitting end to a perfect holiday. We never told them that we were on our honeymoon, and so were quite surprised when, some months later, when we visited them in their home in Surrey, they said that they had known all along. In the morning we handed back the boat, packed the luggage into the car, and set off for home. After our leisurely pace on the river, we found it strange to be going at speed again, and even 30 miles an hour felt as if we were going too fast. We needed to do some shopping, so we decided to stop at Norwich, where, once we had completed our chores, we could have a look around the city. We found a large car park with somewhat sombre name of Tombland. Once we had finished our shopping, we started to wander around the various streets and alleyways until we found ourselves in what was obviously the business quarter. The area was very similar, but on a much smaller scale, to the City of London. We now felt that it was time to get back to the car, but realised that we were completely disoriented. We had no idea in which direction we should go to find the car. And we were further dismayed when we asked directions of a passerby to be told by him to get on a certain bus, as it was some distance away. It was fortunate that we could remember the name of the car park, and he was very doubtful when we said that we would prefer to walk. But he set us off in the right direction, and after a pretty long trek, we finally reached the car park, and thankfully climbed into Joe and started off for home, back to our flat in Northwood Hills.
Happy memories, Dad.
And this is the Narrowboat Erica, signing off for the night and wishing you a very restful and peaceful night. Good night. Temperature outside, 9.7 degrees. Inside, 23 degrees. Humidity, 72%. Dew point, 5 degrees. Wind direction, west. Wind strength, 21 miles per hour. Barometric pressure, 995.6, rising. Cloud cover, 30%. Cloud ceiling, none. Precipitation, 6.86 millimeters. Moon phase, 10.3%, waning crescent. Day length, 7 hours, 51 minutes. Sunset, 15:55. Sky casting, 8:05.